This episode is brought to you by A Dozen Cousins, soulfully seasoned, ready-to-eat beans. Learn more at adozencousins.com.
This week on Meet & Three, it's all about screens. We're diving into the world of TV, computers, and even VR to figure out how food consumption is shifted by a digital lens.
Every course talks about a different topic within the Asian American identity through a very personal lens. And the three courses that are paired with VR, in it, you're seeing a brushstroke by brushstroke recreation of the dish that you're about to eat.
Most of us in the world live in urban areas. And so how much is the city already accidentally providing its residents? And how much more could it provide if we just made it a priority?
Tune in to Meet & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Item 13, an African food podcast, and I'm your host, Yom Akuaku. Every week, we'll delve into the delicious world of African food, including chefs, curators, and bloggers. Here's the show.
Welcome to the show, Ade. I'm excited to have you. I'm so thrilled to have you on. You're calling in from home, right?
Yes, I am. I'm so excited to be here as well. But yes, I am calling in from home.
Well, where's home? Let's people know where home is.
Yes, home for me is Porto-Novo, Benin, which is the tiniest of countries on the west coast of Africa.
Cool. And I actually met you in your second home, I guess. Back stateside in Raleigh earlier this year, actually, was when I first met Ade in the most, I shouldn't say unusual, but like interesting circumstances, I guess. Because I'd heard about you through a mutual friend of ours, Chef Z, and ended up in Raleigh for an event. And I reached out to her randomly. I just sent her, I think I sent a DM actually, because I don't even think I knew.
Yep. Yes.
You know, I'm in town. You don't know me, but we know Z. Like to catch up, hang out, whatever. And Ade was like, yes, please come over. And that for me, like, 2020 has been like crazy, but that for me was one of the highlights of the year. Like, you took me in. Okay, I went, it just felt like so home because I was traveling alone and I didn't know anyone in Raleigh. And I was just there for the night after an event I was at. And I'm naturally an introvert. So in my head, I was like, okay, I'm going to see this girl, you know, chit chat for an hour and then I'll come back to the hotel and just relax till my flight tomorrow morning. But I ended up staying, like, I think I got there around 7. Oh, I got up to 7 and we stayed till 1 a.m. Just, like, eating, drinking. So, like, such a homely... And I'm sure when we talk about your business doing PC, maybe that's the feeling you're trying to actually recreate. Because I felt that when I was in your home. Like, I'm not typically the one, especially for a first-time meeting, to, like, hang out for that long. But... you just made it feel so much like home. And I appreciate, I remember, I will never forget that. If I ever write a biography or autobiography, that will be one of my stories for sure.
Oh, my goodness. That is so kind of you to say. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was really kind of you guys. You don't understand. Like when this episode goes out, I'll post this spread of food that she made. Like I was, for someone that she'd never met, I was blown away by your hospitality. So thank you for taking me into your home and feeding me and just being all around great. So I've given you a little snippet into who I know Ade to be, but now I want you to tell us who you are, a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and your influences growing up.
Yes, absolutely. So like I mentioned earlier, I'm from Porto-Novo, Benin. Porto-Novo is the capital of our country. And I grew up in this little town called Hueme Detromede. I was there till I was about 10 years old. I was born to a military father. He was the captain of the gendarmerie, we call it here. And my mother she would never admit this because she's so humble, but she was quite the entrepreneur herself. Mm-hmm. And at about 10 years old, I was adopted, and that's how I found myself in the States, in the United States. And from that time, I grew up in Connecticut from 10 till about 17 years old. I grew up in Connecticut, but, you know, some of my influences have got to just simply be the African woman, mm-hmm. Watching my mother and my grandmother. Oh, my goodness. Let me just say that woman is 87 years old. I went to visit her on my trip here. She lives, my mother is from Togo, which is the country right next door to Benin.
And oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And that was like a beautiful thing to me because it's been 19 years since I've been home. Mm-hmm. And it's been so, like, my grandparents have never seen me as a woman. And so that in itself was like, I'm never going to get the experience of going and seeing them. And my grandmother is 87 years old. Her domain is the kitchen. She refuses to leave that kitchen. She wakes up in the morning, brings her little basket, and puts everything from the kitchen inside the house that she's going to use all day. Then she goes outside. That's where her kitchen is set up. She doesn't want to use the kitchen inside. She sits outside. She has a little sofa there. She sits there, and she'll sit there all day and cook. Wow. And she'll come inside when it's time to actually eat. So I've never forgotten my grandmother's cooking, my mémé and my mother's side. My mother is also a wonderful cook. And I'll never admit this to any of the women influences in my life. But my father was actually probably the best cook I've ever known.
Wow.
So don't tell anybody. I said,
Did he cook a lot?
My father, he did not cook a lot because he, you know, the mom cooks most of the time, but Sundays was my father's day. Sundays he was in the kitchen, and he would start off when we were sent off to church. We would come back home and he would make sardine omelets for us, and that's how we'd start. And then he'd make all types of sauces, and I actually have a salad on my menu that's called la terre, which in French means earth. And that's because we don't eat salads here. Like, what is a salad? We don't do that here. but my father always made the salad, and he always put beets in it. And I have that on my menu, not to pay homage to him, because he was, I mean, just an amazing cook. And the salad that he made, had beets and all sorts of things, but I do golden beets and red beets, and I put halloumi cheese and all sorts of citrusy things on there, just to remember some of the small things, you know, that I saw my father doing. That's just a little bit.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me how you have like such a vivid memory of like even your food culture growing up in Benin States. Since you left like at 10, right? You said you left at 10. Mm-hmm. Even within those first 10 years, it's interesting to me. I feel like I barely have good, not good, but like vivid memories of stuff growing up like that. It sounds then like cooking and maybe even family and communal eating was like a big part of your family culture, I guess, family food culture growing up. How was that different when you moved to, you know, to your adopted family, I guess?
Oh, girl, let me tell you. so I remember always having three meals a day at the table as a family. So my mother, God bless her, I'm just so proud of the person that she is as I'm now learning more about her. She would wake up in the morning and make breakfast for us. We'd eat and go to school. Then we'd come back in the afternoon and have lunch again as a family. She would cook and have it all ready. We'd walk back to school, come back in the evening time. She would have cooked again. She'd bathe us, and then it was time for us to eat again. So the dinner table, that communal style, is something that has never, it's been like engraved in my mind. And when I came to the States, it was very different. You see, the culture here in the United States is very different. It's like fast paced, right? Because a lot of everybody's working, everybody's trying to find themselves and make ends meet, men and women. And so mostly it was like 6 a.m, we'd like get cereal if you could before catching the bus, eating whatever food they had at lunch, which I mean, really isn't that great for you. The school system, that's a whole nother story. They don't give you the best of options for your children. But we don't have enough time to get into that right now. And then at dinner time, it would be like we would come home and my adoptive parents, they would still be working. And so my sisters and I each had days that we cooked in the week. That was like our part of our chore. And so we made sure food was ready for all the kids. I grew up in a household that had a household of seven. And so we would then eat in the breakfast room, and there was a table in the breakfast room. So that idea of coming and sitting together as a family unit, I didn't have that in the same way I had it here in my home in Benin. So it's very different.
Yeah, that sounds so different. It's interesting to me that you and I guess your siblings were also cooking for them. So I don't know if you learned how to cook before you moved, or what was the cooking learning? No, how did you learn how to cook, I should say?
So funny enough, there wasn't, I learned how to cook by just watching. So I'd be around my grandmother. Both my grandmothers on my mother's side and my father's side were my grandmother on my father's side has passed away. My mama's mother is still alive, but both of them amazing cooks. So being around and just watching, they ask you to do little things, right? And my father, same thing, just kind of just being behind him and watching. And we don't learn in the African culture. I'm not sure if it's the same way in Ghana, but there's no such thing as recipes. When you're there, you're quiet. No. You're not getting in the way. You're sitting somewhere and you're like, okay, I'm watching. And you're being asked to maybe chop some tomatoes or something. There's not like a measurement, put a cup of this in here, 1 teaspoon of that. There's no such thing. And so I learned to cook that way. And when I came here to the States, I'll never forget. There was never a like, okay, this is how you do this, because my adoptive mother's Puerto Rican. And on one Sunday, she was like, hey, I'm going to work, but I need you to make arroz con gandules, which basically is red rice with pigeon pea. I'm like, God, I've never made this in my life. I'm looking at the rice bag, like, okay, what are the instructions? How much water do I need to? If I told you I spent all day trying to make this rice, it would not be an exaggeration.
Oh my God. How old were you by then?
I was 10. I was in fifth grade.
Oh wow. So this is like soon after you came.
Yes.
Wow.
Let me tell you, that moment, actually, my failure of making arroz con gandules and what happened from my ultimate failure of making this arroz con gandules actually deterred, like pushed me away from food, period. I actually hated cooking. I did it, but I hated it. I wanted nothing to do with it, actually. Growing up, being in the United States wasn't something that I enjoyed because there was no love in it for me. It was this thing I felt that I had to do or else I'd get in trouble. And that was it. There wasn't that free feeling of being next to my mom or being next to my grandmother or my father and just watching, which is how like generations and generations, African food is transcended that way from mother to child and sometimes father to child. That was taken away, that pleasure was taken away, or that desire was taken away, and I really hated it, not even gonna lie. My sisters now find it so funny that this is what I'm doing. They're like, how?
It's actually quite interesting too, because I think, and maybe, you know, maybe our stories diverge in that way, but for me, so obviously, so I grew up, you know, back at home, and I was still in the States. And similar to you, or maybe, I guess because I was at home for longer, I didn't just learn how to cook by observing, but eventually, like, by the time I was 14 or 15, I was cooking my family. And, like, literally, I went to the market every weekend with my mom. I knew how to, and this might sound gross for, like, an American listening audience, but I knew how to, like, you know, like, they would kill, like, livestock in our backyard. So, like, I knew how to deal with it. I knew how to deal with a chicken once, you know, it was all ready to be cooked, dip it in water, pull the feathers, like get the whole thing ready. I knew how to do crabs and snails, like clean them out and all of that. Back then I thought disgusting stuff, but it was the thing, like it was what I had to do. And so, I mean, now as an adult, I'm super grateful for it. But back then, especially going to the market, I did not enjoy that because my mother was also like a big, she also liked to bargain quite a bit, and you know that we do that back home. And so it's so hot. Like, why aren't we just buying these tomatoes? Like, we walk around the whole market and we come back to this and buy it anyway. So for me, like, I think it's also interesting to people that, especially to my family, that I'm in the food space now, because I did not enjoy cooking. And there's a lot of people who assume that I do because of the stuff I share on Instagram and all of that. I cook a lot, but I just don't. It's not
a passion, maybe.
It's just a passion. Like, I will cook, sometimes I'll cook with passion when I'm really in the mood or I want to cook something really special, then it's fun for me. But when I'm cooking out of necessity, like right now with this, with COVID and being stuck at home, like a lot of us are cooking more, and so for me it's not as fun, right? Because I have to cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So it's more like, oh, I'm doing it for sustenance rather than like, oh, this is doing out of enjoyment. So I totally get that. And I can get the disconnect that people will see from like, oh, you're in the food space. You don't like food. Although it sounds like that has changed for you, right? So how did you go from feeling that way to getting into doing what you do now in terms of Dunu cuisine? Actually, yeah, this is probably a good time for you to tell us about Dunu cuisine.
Yes, absolutely. So Dunu cuisine is my first business, and it's private chef services, and we do we host private dinners and catering and all sorts of things of that nature. And Dunu comes from the term Wamij Dunu, which is from one of my native dialects. Let me not say dialects, let me say one of my first languages, excuse me, which is Fon. And it means come share a meal with me. Naturally, when we're home and we're eating and someone walks in, you're like, you either say Viens faire comme nous, which is French for like, come do like us, come join me. Mm-hmm. Where you say, Wamij Dunu, like come and sit and share this meal with me. And then we do that. And you don't say it trying to be polite. It's like literally you're saying, grab a plate, grab a seat, and my plate is here, let's eat together. And that's like naturally what we do. And I thought there was no better name to describe what I was actually trying to invoke, which is that communal. You know, all my dinners, we sit on a long communal table, just as I remembered at home before I left, and you sit with strangers so that you can have conversations that's centered around food and who we are as a people and our culture and our customs, so we can see that while there's all these differences that separate us, there's so much more that brings us together. And there's no better way to do that with food. And so that's the basis of Dunu cuisine.
Oh, cool. And it's so interesting because the first time I saw the full name of your business, we say Wamij Dunu also. Yeah, we do. So this is why, like, I remember when I first saw the name of the business, it resonated with me because before I started like my platform, I was actually going to, and then I've discovered Mi Dunu. You know, I'm sure you know Mi Dunu in Ghana, who Selassie actually has and stuff. So when I just wanted to Google to make sure nobody was using it, and then that's how I discovered his business actually. So she and I are actually from the same tribal ethnic group. So that's interesting to me. And then when you talked about that idea, so like it's very similar, you like Bami Dinu, like that whole culture of like always making sure, you know, inviting people to come in and eat and share that food. Reminded me of how growing up, like we would always make more than we needed, even though we may not have had as much, with the anticipation that anytime anyone walked through the door, they would be welcome to eat at the table. So like what you shared just sort of took me back then and resonates. Like my mom would always make big pots of soup, and if we made jollof, it was always a big pot because you always had the anticipation that you walk in and you wanted to be able to offer something to eat.
And you couldn't be more right, you know, and I'm seeing that more and more as I've come back home. And I see my mother spends her time in France and Benin. And when my father died 11 years ago, and I've always had this worry for my mom, like when she comes back home, like what does she do? Like,
yeah,
are they, you know, is there somebody here? Like, how does she still carry on? And let me just tell you how blown away I am by the space she's built for herself, and it didn't come from just nothing, right? You know, my mom ran a boutique. My mom ran a small restaurant out here. I remember that even when I was a child. And so there isn't a day since I've been here that a woman or mother doesn't send her child here to ask mom if she needs them to grab her anything. Mm-hmm. Or any of like the sisters or the aunties come in. Any time my mom is ready to cook, she automatically, there's like five women that come in and do everything for her. So she's built this thing, this relationship with people around her that she's never alone, and she always cooks for everyone to be able to share. And it just is a testament to, again, that culture that we have of community, because everything that I'm even amazed by this as I'm still saying this to you, that literally every day there's anything that even I have needed, she has found a way. Someone has always been accessible to make it happen for us, and it's been such an amazing thing to watch and just solidified for me what I've remembered as a child being away for so long. So it's very true what you're saying.
Yeah, that's incredible. And actually brings me to, since you're talking about your mom's cooking, brings to the point where I want to talk about what many people eat. So I think this is a good time to take a break. And then when we come back from the break, you can tell us about all the delicious food you're eating at home, and then maybe use that to educate us on what Benin food is all about.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, awesome. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by A Dozen Cousins, soulfully seasoned, ready-to-eat beans. A Dozen Cousins aims to bring families delicious and easy-to-prepare food inspired by traditional Black and Latino recipes. From their Cuban black beans made with onion, garlic, and bell peppers, to their Mexican cowboy beans made with green chilies and jalapenos, all the beans from A Dozen Cousins use easy-to-recognize ingredients like beans, vegetables, and nutrient-dense avocado oil, while avoiding GMOs and artificial flavors. Learn more at adozencousins.com.
So we are back. Now time to talk about food. So tell us, what have you been eating, and what can we learn about what Benin people eat?
Absolutely. First of all, let me say, like, what have I not been eating? I've been stuffing my face here. I thought I was going to lose weight, but I see that's literally not what's going to happen. But I'm still happy about it. So we're right on the coast. So we have a lot of fresh fish. So a lot of our food like consists of seafood and a whole lot of fish. So we have dishes like mollo, which is a tomato-based sauce that you can either grill, smoke, or fry fish and use that in. We have lots of vegetable dishes, which is so funny because anyone from East Africa would be like, oh, West Africans really eat meat. But we do have a lot of, there's a particular dish that we call ma, which is hearty and has lots of different greens in there. And so there's so many different ways to make that as well. But recently, one of the women in the neighborhood here made a ma that I would never forget in my life. And she, it is not typical. Usually it's wet. We'll use like palm oil and we'll boil the leaves and we'll fry a bunch of things and then add it in there. And it's wet, but she made a dry version using gusi, which Nigerians use, you know, a lot of their dishes as well. And what she did was she blended a bunch of green spicy peppers and she fried that in oil with the gusi. And then she added the greens and she added some smoked fish in there and some cow skin. Yorm, when I tell you, I'm like, she's going to make it again this week for me because it's literally the most amazing thing I've ever had in my life. It was so, so good.
And so, I can smell it from here, actually. Oh, my goodness.
It's just, it was so amazing. And I was so blown away by the ability she had of not making it, of making it dry, because typically it is wet. It's like when you see collard greens from the States, the wetness, but it's on our end is a little bit thicker because you were using it, we're eating it with like a probably a starchy side. And so I was just amazed by all the flavor she got in there. And so she's going to teach me how to make it this week because I'm not leaving here without knowing that.
I was going to ask you, are you going to learn how to make it and bring it back to your menu here in the States?
Absolutely. I already told her there's no way. I need to learn how to make this because it was so delicious. And it just shows a different side of our food, you know, because we use a lot of tomato-based things. Mm-hmm. We eat a lot of tomato-based things, and it's just a different side of it. We do eat pork as well, like the grilled pork or fried pork. We have a dish called palankete, which is basically what that means is that the sauce we cook is made with the blood of the animal. So you can use goat or you can use pork, and it's made. You use the blood to make the sauce. Now, as we know, people, there are different ones now that you don't just use the blood anymore. You can use other thickeners like flour, you know. So they have different versions now. But when I was a child, I always remember it being the blood of the meat is what we use to cook. And we eat that with eba, which is like cassava greens that you cook. And it forms this thick substance that you eat that with. And also, so here's the thing, you know, there's always this Ghanaian and Nigerian and maybe like, what other country? You know, you always hear Nigerian and Ghana, jollof wars, right?
Yes, even Liberia has put themselves into this jollof wars.
So I have no intentions of coming into this war now, but I simply want to say that Benin, we also have a version of the rice that y'all would call jollof.
She said the rice that y'all call jollof.
You know, I wanted to put it aside because I'm not trying to get into it. I don't want to, we're not going to come into the war. Y'all got it. But it's called Rio Gras. And so we, it's like the same base of what you guys do. And then we add like cabbage. I remember my mom always doing the shot cabbage. And it's like super spicy. The difference I would say is, I don't know if different countries use like palm oil in their rice. I've seen it in some Nigerian jollofs that there's palm oil in there, which I particularly like. But it seems like the one we do is a lot more dry than most jollofs that I've seen. Mm-hmm. But we have that as well. We have a Rio Gras, which is not to be compared to jollof rice, but somewhat similar. and we have a lot of like just grilled meat, grilled duck, grilled turkey, grilled pork, grilled beef. And what else can I say? Like, oh, I would say two of my favorite sauces, we eat a sauce d'arachide, which is a peanut-based sauce. It's probably the most known sauce in Benin. And then we have sauce graine, which is made of palm hearts, right? Okay. And so I literally, when I was in Lomé, I watched my grandmother make it from scratch, how she doesn't have the strength now to boil and then pound the palm
hearts.
But I watched the whole process of how we boil it and then we beat it and then we separate all the. And it, let me tell you, it was the most amazing sauce blend that I've ever had in my life. I may be biased because it's my mémé, but it was amazing. And that's also really big here. And we do eat pounded yam. Now, I just learned that pounded plantain is more of an Ivory Coast thing versus the pounded yam, which is more of what we do here in Benin, which is coming from like cassava.
Or
yam, we would call it here. So that's something that I learned, the distinctive difference between that. But that's some of the things that I've been eating. And also, atasi, which is a very big thing that we eat here in the morning, which is like rice and peas, which is, would be similar to what people know as Jamaican rice and peas.
Mm-hmm.
And then we eat that with fried fish, maybe a boiled egg, and then sauce ja. Sauce ja is a really reduced sauce made of tomato, onions, and spicy peppers that you continuously fry and reduce. So you want it to be this thick substance. And in Ghana, I think that y'all add your black shiito pepper, right?
I was just going to say that what you just described also sounds like wache for us. So we also have a rice and beans dish called wache, which we would typically have with like some sort of protein, boiled egg, and then shito and then stew. And then shito is, it's exactly that idea of like we fry, you basically cook it all the way down, partly because it's also a preservation technique that it lasts longer. And then we use dried fish and dried shrimp to give it like a I guess what they say these days, umami, smoky, yeah. So no, that sounds amazing. Like, actually sounds very similar. I guess there's similarities in West African food, but it sounds more similar to Ghanaian food than what.
I think I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I think I would agree with that. But atasi, literally, when I got off the plane and I finally went through all the dramatics that we had to go through at the airport and I got into the car, I was like, Mom, what I want for breakfast tomorrow is atasi. That's
and actually, wache is the breakfast. It's actually considered a breakfast food. So like in a lot of places, so it's a street food. And in a lot of places, if you don't get there at like 10, it's all gone. So,
that's
interesting. Yeah. So I'm going to bring you back to stateside. just in thinking about the work you do with Junu in your home, well, I guess your adopted city of Raleigh. What's been your experience with, I want to say African food, but I'll narrow it down to West African food in Raleigh. And in terms of one bringing, you know, helping your business grow, like what is the appetite of the people in the city to accepting your food?
Right.
And then just also, if it's related at all, like you said your adoptive family was Puerto Rican, if you've had any influence on that in your cooking as well.
Yeah, that's a lovely question. So where I am, you know, there's no representation of West African food. You know, you see some East African food, you see, you know, Moroccan, you see Kenyan, even maybe some South African food. And I'm going to even say typically, you know, if you're not in a big city, like your New York's or like maybe your DC, I don't know if that's really a thing, if with African food is really represented to the same extent as the other regions of Africa maybe. And so typically, I want to say that there is an appetite for it, especially as I started this journey of introducing it to people. And the whole basis of what I'm doing is to not only, I want to keep the authenticity of what West African food is, but also because it is now in the hands of us as young female chefs or young chefs in general. I think it's up to now, it's up to us now to reintroduce this thing to people. And so I may make you some, you know, pounded yam and this sauce dashi that I talked about a little bit ago, but it's not going to look the same way, right? Because I'm interpreting it my way, but the basis of the value of what the food is doesn't change. And I want West African food to be just as fine dining as any other food that you see right. That has already been food, you know, like French food, Indian food, even, you know, Mexican food, Latin food. I want West African food to be at that same caliber. And I think that as I'm continuing to do what I do, there's more people who are aware of it now. I've started building somewhat of a base of support and people who are really interested in the food that I make. And then, you know, where that actual whole idea came from for me, because I didn't answer this question a bit ago, was about like, how did I come back into food? How did I fall in love with it again? And it's because at the age of, I want to say maybe I was 19, I started working, or 20, I started working at this small boutique hotel in the heart of Yale. And in this hotel, they had a restaurant, but it's still there, called Heirloom. Heirloom was the farm-to-table, a farm-to-table restaurant. And that, I had always worked in the restaurant industry, but I hadn't worked in fine dining before this experience. And as I started working there, I realized that, oh, people actually want to come in here and spend this money and eat the food. And I started to understand the intent and that this is intentional. Like, food can be intentional. Mm-hmm. And then it connected with me about how I can share my story and I can tell a story with the food. And it just really, I gravitated to it. It almost became an obsession. Like, how can I do this? And slowly, you know, I started to do pop-up dinners that really, I'm speaking not just about food, I'm talking about a culture. Sometimes I bring adoption into it, in a very like gentle way. It's not abrasive. Yeah. But it's really to make people think about like the world that we live in and how we view Africa from like a third person perspective. And so definitely to go back to answering the second question about the Puerto Rican influence, yes, absolutely. I mean, I was still in the kitchen with my abuelita, learning how to make pasteles, learning how to make piñon, learning how to make pernil, learning how to make so many different Puerto Rican food. And that also showed me some of the similarities. And that's also very engraved in what I do in bridging the gap between cultures and us understanding that, like, when we talk about transatlantic slave trade, there's a reason why we can look at rice and peas in Jamaica and make this connection to this atafi we eat here and in Ghana. So let's not forget that all that stuff comes from somewhere. And I want us to have, you know, maybe not necessarily just have a seat at the table when we talk about food and history of food, but maybe we can build our own table as well. We're not talked about when we talk about food and history of food.
Yeah, this actually reminds me so much of the conversation we had back when you know, I first met you about, you know, bringing one, building our own table is for sure, and then bringing that conversation about Africa and African food and our culture, and eventually how do we use all of that to help develop you know, economies back home. Yeah. So I'm always sort of interested in people thinking about how that all of that connects, right?
Absolutely. And I've had the most humbling experiences now that I've been here, and I've been back home. I've been here maybe 3 weeks now. And you know, my sole reason for coming here is I have a spice line that is just about to launch, but I'm changing my concept and making sure that I'm sourcing all my food from local women here, like from the market. And so I've been in the market, I've been doing all this research, I've been connecting with all these different women out here. And one thing that I noticed, and I was having a conversation with my mom, I'm like, how come all the women who sell tomatoes are all sitting next to each other? And this me thinking, you know, the way I would think probably from an outsider perspective, right? I'm saying, if I'm selling tomatoes, like, why am I not where someone sells onions or where someone sells garlic? So that way, like, all that stuff goes together, right? And there's me just thinking like that. Or then I say, well, why aren't they all getting together? And then saying, okay, how can we work together to maybe because we're all sourcing our tomatoes from the same place, how can we now form this type of like system where we all are winning and helping each other? And then maybe that actually affects us at home in a different way, a more positive way, right? And then I have to realize, wait a day, you're talking from a place of privilege,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I had this the most humbling experience. Because I'm like, my heart is like, okay, how can we, you know, stunt our economy, but at all the way at the level in which it actually affects our everyday people, not just big companies, right, that are built here. And I had to think, stop myself for a second and realize that I've had the opportunity to be outside of here. And where we are here in my country, these women, it's like you're thinking about right now. How can I sell the most amount of tomatoes so that I can feed my family or that I can save enough so that my daughter has the opportunity, it's not guaranteed, the opportunity or the privilege to go to school. Yeah. And so I have to remember that for a moment and think outside of the entrepreneurial, whatever that word is, mindset that you build when you're in the States maybe, and things are just not the same.
Yeah.
And it's been humbling.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying it's been really humbling.
Yeah. And I was gonna say too, just to that point, it's also that that the mindset in some ways the mindset is different. Because I remember when I first moved here, and I don't know what it was about particularly, but I just remember, like, you know, people being surprised that, you know, someone had an extra thing going on besides their day job or whatever, and they called it like the new like side hustle economy or blah blah blah, whatever that was. And I was like, I remember thinking, that's not new. Growing up, like, I knew people who, like, my mom was this or my dad was this, but they always had something else going on. And not necessarily because they wanted to. It was mostly out of necessity, right? You needed to be able to supplement your income, again, if you wanted that opportunity or that privilege for your family. But people were doing this and were already finding ways to manage juggling all of that so that they would be able to provide opportunity, you know, if they wanted better, much better for their children than they ever had. So it's also about reframing, like, the things that we see and maybe understanding the cultural lens through which that is happening versus what we've seen outside of the continent. So.
Absolutely. And to your point, African women, I just have to say I'm so proud to be an African woman.
Yeah.
Literally, like, are the MVPs of, like, entrepreneurship.
Yep.
All these women hustling every single day from sun up to sun down to just provide for their family. And it's just this amazing thing that you're driving and you see them, you know, like they set up their little thing and maybe they're selling fried yam or even gas. Like, it's just, oh my goodness, if you're an African woman and you're listening, I lift you up. You are my mother, my sister, my auntie, my grandmother, all the above, and I just support you. I lift you up. I tell you courage, because you know we are so strong, and we define the commerce of this African culture that we know. I can be more proud to be an African woman.
We are just about to wrap up, but you mentioned something like very quickly, you glossed it right, and I want to make sure that people catch that. Is it at a point where you can share a little bit more about it, or?
Yeah, absolutely, I can. So the spice line is called Ilewa by Zulu Cuisine. Ilewa is a Yoruba word that means home, like our home. And, you know, the logic of this is that we want to bring a little bit of Africa into your kitchen. And so we have, like, I've made a traditional spice, which is more similar to suya, and that's the traditional one. And then in light of really saying that, you know, African food is transcended from woman to, or mother to child, generation to generation, and now it's my turn, you know, as this is my generation, to now reintroduce African food to the world, I then now made my version of something. So we have a traditional suya spice, and then we have a coffee suya rub, which is delicious, if I say so myself.
I'm sure it is. Like, having experienced the way you work with flavors, I'm 100% sure that it is.
Thank you so much. But now that I've been here, I've found so many more inspirations. So there's going to be more spices that are added on, but currently, you know, we have some stores that we'll be going into very soon, but we'll also be selling, you know, online, our website, but I'm really, really excited for it, for that, really excited for that, because, for example, suya is not something, or a lot of these spices is not something that you see at like a local, a grocery store. Like, you're not going to go to Whole Foods and find this. You're not going to go to whatever grocery store you have in your state. You're not going to see that. And I'm on like this mission of getting our spices into more accessible areas, and not just, you know, not just the local African market, which might not even be near you. Yeah. And I learned this because COVID has really changed the way most of us are doing business. And I've had to, like, my business literally stopped because people weren't able to gather. So I had to switch really quickly. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to host cooking classes with, like, large corporations. They've reached out to me, and we've done cooking classes for, like, you know, their team building stuff, which has been so fun. Really interesting, because, like, I like touching, I like seeing people, I like hugging people. But it's been different, but still wonderful. And I realized, as I was trying to send these recipes out and these grocery lists, I'm like, where are people going to find suya? And then I was like, I have my own. How can I get it to everybody who is, like, in California, which literally is something that happened, or who is, like, in a different country? Right. I was like, okay, how can I change this? Because suya is a part of my recipe, but now I have to change it because it's not accessible. And I was like, that's not okay. We really need to work on that. So, like, I'm on this mission of getting it into grocery stores so it's accessible and that people can.
Yeah, that's amazing. More. That's amazing. And I agree. Like, that is the turning point. I feel strongly, and some may disagree, that we need to get into mainstream. Like, I think there's a lot of good work happening, like, in the African food space. We're getting a lot more visibility, although the visibility, I personally feel, is limited to, like, just a few people. So I think there's work that needs to be done to elevate the work of a lot more people. And, you know, like, earlier this year, it's just, there's still a lot of work to do, which means there's a lot more opportunities. So it's exciting times for sure. And even in adversity, there's a lot to look forward to.
And, like, a quick shout out to Chef Pierre, who is doing exactly, I'm, like, a great supporter of him, and also, like, He's one of like the people that I watch, like, how is he doing this? You know, I'm learning so much from him. And he's brought Fonio. He's done it.
Yeah. He's definitely mainstream, and they do a lot of work with education, educating people about the brain, now coming up with different flavors and products with Fonio. So he's doing good work. I agree. Running out of time, so just before we do the rapid fire, can you let people know where they can find you online, on social media?
Mm-hmm. You can find us online at dounoucuisine.com, and that's dounou cuisine. And you can find us on Facebook and on Instagram, same thing, Dounou Cuisine. And you know, you can email us. Our contact information is on there for any questions. And, you know, we're always open to getting feedback and hearing everyone's perspective. So don't hesitate to, like, send us an email or even call. We're always ready for that. So those are places where you can find us.
Cool. All right. Now we'll do the rapid fire segment very quickly. I asked you this as the example, but why not? Coffee or tea?
Ooh, okay, that's hard. Definitely, I'm going to say coffee and tea because there's a time for each of those things. Like coffee in the morning, and then I love lemongrass leaves, which is a big thing here.
That's good.
Like, you know, I got to drink that. That's amazing. So I can't choose coffee and tea, please.
Yeah. Morning person or night person?
Oh my God, I'm going to sound like, does this girl even know herself? but like, it really depends. I can wake up super early or I cannot. It depends. But really, I have to stay on both. But if I have to pick one, I can be a night owl sometimes.
Okay, so probably night person then. Mm-hmm. Sweet or salty?
Ooh. These are, I mean, I like them both. This is so hard. Sweet or salty? Oh my God. You know, you can't do this to me. I love food too much to
say. Okay. Let me ask you something not related to food, this likely not related to food. I guess I don't even know if you're watching Netflix or you're at home. What's your favorite Netflix show? What are you watching on Netflix right now that you like?
So I am watching Fresh Prince of Bel-Air because yes, they've brought these 90s shows onto Netflix. Thank you, Netflix. And before then I was watching Living Single. I love those types of shows.
Oh, yeah.
Oh man, when TV represented us.
Right? I don't know what happened. I've been watching Moesha.
Moesha. You know, people used to tell me I was a child that looked like her. I'm not sure why or how, but I'll take it. But that was a good one too.
Yeah. And then last question, which is probably as aspirational, but you know. What would you do if you knew you could not fail?
What would I do if I knew I could not fail?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. So literally my heart lies in Africa. And my heart is all about like progressing our women, or making it easier for our women to do business here in Africa. So if I could not fail, I would find a way to maybe change our market system so that women doesn't feel like a struggle.
Yeah.
And that there's less stress in it, and the haggling, you know, maybe could change. And as a business person, this woman can say, hey, my tomato costs this much, and like, we just pay it. Yeah. That is my, if I could do anything in the world, it would be that.
That's Sweet. Cool. Well, that's all I have for you. Thank you so, so much for your time. Thank you for making time out of your eating schedule.
Yeah, you can call it that, absolutely.
To chat with me. I've enjoyed sharing your story. Like I said, like when I first met you, you really, really touched my heart. And I thought, just learning more about your story, I thought it would be great to share with the rest of the world. So thank you so much.
That is so sweet. Thank you very much. And I can't wait for, Corona to kind of wrap this up so we can all be able to get together again and
some delicious food.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure. It's such a wonderful conversation. I wish, you know what, we just need to have a phone call and we can just still talk about these things.
I know. Like, this is what I said. Like, back in January, I don't know if it was January or February, like, when I planned to meet you, I was just like, oh, I'm going to do this. Like, I'll stop by, say hi for an hour, and we'll just forever. So,
Definitely. We must do it again. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Item 13, an African food podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. To keep up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Item 13 Podcast. Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.